Hello and welcome to Filibustering History, a podcast series where we discuss what historians do with their lives. I am Rob Denning, lead faculty for the history programs at Southern New Hampshire University's College of Online and Continuing Education. Today, James Fennessy, the Associate Dean of Faculty for History at SNHU, and I are going to put on some fatigues and transport ourselves through the magic of the interwebs to Texas, where we're going to talk to Dr. Everett Daig, the command historian for the U.S. Army Sergeant's Major Academy at Fort Bliss. We're going to talk a bit about the history and importance of non-commissioned officers to the modern army, the USASMA itself, USASMA as we insiders get to call it, and how one gains the title of command historian. What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Everett Daig, and I teach at Southern New Hampshire in the history department, and I am the command historian for the United States Army Sergeant Major's Academy.
Wow, command historian is an excellent title. So,
well, a command historian, the way command historians work in the Army is all units, all military units at most levels have a command historian. And what their function is to collect the history of that particular command, that particular unit. As the command historian for a college in the Army University, I have a lot of other duties. Not only do I look at the history of the school itself and keep up with the history of the school itself, but the Sergeant Major's Academy is the center of non-commissioned officer education. And we are currently working on accreditation to be able to offer both bachelor and master's degrees. We have a couple of programs that already work along those lines. In addition to working with sergeant majors and teaching people how to be a sergeant major at whatever level they will work at being a sergeant major, it's also the center of all NCO education, from very basic education, what's called the basic NCO course, up to the graduate level sergeant major type thing. And it's something that the Army has been pushing a lot lately. They're moving toward a much more educated NCO Corps, which is essential as far as the way the Army conducts operations. There's a concept now called the Strategic Corporal. And the idea behind the Strategic Corporal is that in a world of 24-hour news cycles, you know, if a corporal is in charge of a village in Afghanistan, for example, which is something you would not have seen 10 or 20 years ago, the decisions that that corporal makes can have a worldwide impact. If a corporal makes a decision to pull a trigger, for example, because they misunderstand the situation, the president and whoever else might be on the phone within an hour of that sort of thing happening. So it's essential that we have educated non-commissioned officers and educated enlisted people. And education in the enlisted ranks is becoming much, much more important and much more vital to the success of the Army itself. The non-commissioned officer Corps and USASMA, the Sergeant Major's Academy, is actually in charge of all levels of education from E3 up to the Sergeant Major of the Army. So not only do I work with keeping track of the Academy, keeping track of its evolution from an Academy into a college, but I'm also working at all levels with NCO education, reviewing curriculum, reviewing course objectives, all the rest of that stuff, and making sure that the historical components are in accordance with what the Army wants out of education for enlisted people.
Now, the Sergeant Major Academy is, as I'm sure you're aware, is less well known than, you know, the West Points, the Citadel, those types of places.
Yes.
What is the just kind of a short history of that institution? How long has it been around? You've given us a sense of what the student body is, but, you know, what is the mission? Tell us a little bit about the organization itself.
Well, the organization is in a state of change, as the whole attitude toward education itself is. That is one of the things. The idea of an educated NCO Corps is really recent. The school itself was founded in, I believe, 1973. And I've actually, one of the other things I kind of do unofficially slash officially, is I'm the historian of the NCO Corps. And one of my mandates is to address exactly that issue that you just came up with. It's not as well known. The role of NCOs is not as well known. In a lot of ways, non-commissioned officer history is a lot like women's history, where if you go into the archives, you're going to find a lot of history that's written by officers, about officers, doing officerly things. And the role of the NCO has really not been a subject that's been explored. There's a lot there that needs to be looked at. One of the other things that I also do is I talk to people at the University of Texas in El Paso, and to some extent at Texas A&M, because I've got archives. We have archives. No, I have archives. They're my damn archives.
They're yours.
Absolutely. And when we look at NCO history and NCO education itself, we're actually on the verge, I think, of rewriting a lot of what we know or think we know about U.S. military history. I've done a couple of pieces like that. I just got through writing a history of the NCO for the NCO handbook that is going out throughout the Army itself, TC 7.22.7, if you know you want to look it up. And
I'll ask for a link for that later.
I might be able to come up with one if they publish the thing that's come out. But thinking about what the NCOs are and inventing, I don't say inventing, but discovering the NCO history is something that is becoming more and more important. And USASMA is leading the way on that. It's definitely pointing out it's becoming the academic resource more than other elements of the Army College or the Army University, more than any other component out there. So one of the reasons I think that it's not as well known is because we're just now beginning to get into a component where more of the senior NCOs are coming into the senior NCO ranks with college degrees. It used to be 1973 when they first opened this thing, something like 3% of the incoming senior NCOs that were going to take the sergeant major course had bachelor degrees. Now it's about 62%. You really cannot afford to have those strategic corporals making stupid mistakes. They've got to have that liberal arts background, that ability to think and understand multiple perspectives, which of course history does extremely well, in order to make effective and correct decisions. So it's becoming more important, and I think that you will be hearing a lot more about it as time goes on.
That makes sense. I am not a military historian, but I recently, one of my research interests has been the Vietnam War. And there's a lot of books written by, you know, the commissioned officers, and they will usually spend time talking about the importance of the non-commissioned officers, like the sergeants and their contributions to various military campaigns and all of that. But yeah, usually it is the commissioned officers that's kind of the center of attention there. And so just to get a sense of what we're talking about here, what proportion of the military would be coming through an institution like the like yours? Because I imagine there's obviously a huge population of, I'm drawing a blank, the enlisted men. Right. And then there's a pretty sizable population of commissioned officers. And then there's the non-commissioned officers, kind of this group in the middle. But do you have a sense of, proportion-wise, how large of a population are we talking about, and maybe how many of them are going to be coming through your institution?
Well, the thing about it is, if you're going to get promoted, 100% of all non-commissioned officers, non-commissioned officer is a corporal, sergeant, and above. So the way the Army works, you come in as a private E1, then you get to be a private E2, then a private first class, and then usually a specialist, but some of the specialists, these are E4s, can become corporals. And a corporal is considered a non-commissioned officer versus a specialist who is, again, sort of a super enlisted man.
Okay.
So if you are going to join the NCO Corps, which makes up, I believe, about a third of the Army altogether.
Oh, okay.
Maybe even a little bit more. You're going to go through NCO education from the beginning on. And, you know, the basic course is where you first learn the principles of being an NCO. A non-commissioned officer, the way that the Army is still struggling with a definition of what an NCO actually is, but basically you've got commissioned officers that receive a commission from the president, and you have non-commissioned officers Commissioned officers, the way it usually works, the description is they're the father of the unit. They will take care of the unit. They'll think about what the unit's supposed to do. They'll come up with plans and all the rest of that stuff. A non-commissioned, this is a really gross oversimplification.
No problem.
But a non-commissioned officer is the mother of the unit. They're the ones that take care of the men, make sure that the weapons work. They do the training on everything so that when an officer steps in, when he says, Sergeant, do this or that, the unit is ready to go and do that. It's a little bit different and it's changing a little bit as the NCO Corps becomes more educated. And it also is changing because it's achieving and has achieved since Vietnam a more professional identity. It used to be, after World War I, for example, that if you were a soldier, if you stayed in the service, especially after World War I, you were considered kind of a leech on society. In Texas, for example, insane people, convicts, and soldiers were not allowed to vote, you know, because they were thugs, among other things. But that has changed a lot, and USASMA's played a role in that. Vietnam played a major role in that as well. And I think one reason why you get a lot of stuff coming from Vietnam from officers is because there really wasn't a formal training process for NCOs. I mean, basically, you came out of the enlisted ranks, you got really good at your job, and you got assigned to teach other people to do what it is that you did, whereas the officers, you know, you had to have a college degree and all the rest of this kind of stuff. So you get NCOs, traditional old NCOs, that really have no use for education at all. In 1973, when they went to the all-volunteer force, one of the biggest things that attracted people into the military was free education or educational benefits. So beginning in 73, you're beginning to sort of change that. The World War II / Vietnam era, Korean War era NCO would oftentimes join the military, and he could rise all the way to sergeant major without ever setting foot in a college classroom. And as I've heard from many other places, you know, he was the dumbest person in the room when it came to talking about strategy and tactics and what you need to do and all the rest of that stuff. 1973, in Vietnam, the lack of trained NCOs and the shortened tours in Vietnam, typically you get there and you'd be there for a year and you get back out, that's not nearly enough time to teach a new NCO what they're actually supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why the officers would step in and sort of take over the NCO role. And you see that a lot in a lot of writings about Vietnam itself. They started addressing the question of NCO education really about 1970. They created kind of a counterpoint to the officer candidate courses and with what was called the NCOCC or non-commissioned officer candidate course, where 21 weeks you'd go in, you'd come out after 21 weeks, and I think there was a little time period where you had to shadow another NCO, and you'd be commissioned or non-commissioned as a sergeant there. You get sergeant stripes straight away. And that worked out really well. And the idea that you could train someone to be an NCO was something completely new in the Army. And it's still something that is kicking around. A lot of older NCOs don't like it. I hear, since I'm dealing mostly with senior NCOs, that they have no use for education whatsoever. But the reality is, that's the future of the Army. That's the future of where promotion, all the rest of that stuff is going. It's going to be education one way or the other. So my job essentially is making sure that it's done at least historically correctly.
Well, this focus on education is actually a larger trend, not only with the Army, I imagine, given the breakdown that you just provided, but in the workforce itself. I mean, you have an entire generation of students that were raised on with a STEM focus. But so they have this ability to work through logic, to create these, you know, to work with data. What they didn't ever develop were these critical thinking skills, this ability to connect with other human beings through a focus in the liberal arts and humanities. And now there's a real push within, especially management positions and executive positions, for people with these liberal arts backgrounds and to have these people skills and to have these critical thinking skills. And it sounds like this is a similar push with what you're seeing in the military right now, because these people need to be able to think critically. They need to be able to assess situations. They need to be able to work with unknowns and variables and not just be focused on a singular mission, regardless of if anything changes or not.
Right, absolutely. The way the Army expresses it is that any soldier, but NCOs especially, need to be able to operate, quote unquote, within the commander's intent, which means that the captain's not going to come and tell you, go dig your foxhole there. You understand what the mission is. You interpret it, and you work on your own in order to accomplish it. And yeah, you've got to have those critical thinking skills. You've also got to have communication skills, which is a big thing in the Army right now, is to push writing and oral communication, which again, history is really good at teaching you how to do.
And can you tell us a little bit about how you got to this position? So what is your academic and professional background that would bring you through not only instruction and your PhD, but to get to this point where you have such an influential position at this institution?
Well, obviously, the pinnacle of my career was working at Southern New Hampshire.
Well, obviously,
no doubt.
Yes.
Obviously.
Thank you very much.
I am actually a high school dropout, as a matter of fact. And I dropped out of high school in the 11th grade. About a year later, I joined the Army, got out. I banged my knee up pretty badly, and I ended up getting out on a disability and went to the University of South Carolina. And I was originally going to be a secondary school teacher, a high school teacher, and I was going to get an education degree. And then I found out you had to have algebra, and algebra is horrible and evil. Will anybody from the math department hear this?
Possibly, but, you know, we don't care.
No, by all means, if they don't hear it, bring it over to them, because I want them to hear this. Okay. It's evil, pure evil.
I will forward this to them.
Thank you.
Anonymously.
Appreciate that. And remember, my name is Fennessy, James Fennessy.
Yes.
There were a lot of things that I didn't like about education. One of them was content expertise. So you had to give up a lot of what I thought were very important classes in order to take a lot of the electives necessary to get in there. And I'm not criticizing education. I understand why that's the way it is. But I got actually very interested in Napoleon and modern history, which kind of leads to a military background. I'm sort of a military historian and sort of not a military historian. My area of expertise, my PhD, well, I got my master's from the University of South Carolina, and I went to work, I got my PhD from Florida State and the Institute on Napoleon and the French Revolution. One of the things that really interested me is how you build military power. What's the relationship between society, warfighting ability / military power, and governance? How do these three things work together? And no one had ever done any work on Napoleon's Ministry of War. So I ended up writing what remains the definitive book, because it's the only book, but it's still definitive.
We'll take it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. On Napoleon's Ministry of War, and actually I think uncovered some really interesting reasons as to why he failed. There were some serious administrative flaws that comes out of that. And whenever I go to parties, my military history friends tell me that I need to go hang out with the administrative historians, and the administrative historians tell me I need to go hang out with the military people. And I'm only saying that to support Rob's contention that I actually have friends. So thanks, Rob. I appreciate that.
Good for you.
And that has kind of picked up a little bit. It's when I left Florida State, I went to work at Benedictine College, which is in Kansas, and I became the chair of a little three-person department with a whole gaggle of adjuncts. But the way that broke down was that I had one medievalist, one Americanist, and then I got the modern world. Basically, I took that to be from 1492 up to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was the chair, we could do a lot of innovative classes. And I ended up actually learning a great deal about the modern world, which is, I think, a real asset when it comes to working with the senior seminar at Southern New Hampshire, because you have such a range of different ideas about what people want to do. And once you weed out all the people that think that Hitler's okay, then you can proceed on and get some really good stuff.
Right.
After a while, I thought I had kind of reached a plateau at Benedictine. I had tenure and I had all the rest of that stuff, but it was also getting a little on the stale side at that point. And I decided I wanted to go and learn different teaching techniques. Benedictine is a traditional brick and mortar school, very conservative teaching philosophy. It actually was at the point where you couldn't bring a computer into the class because that's not the way people learn. I'm like, well, that's not exactly true.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that attracted me to Southern New Hampshire, is that I really wanted to learn how to do online teaching, online pedagogy. And I've been here long enough to see that it change and evolve a little bit. Because this kind of goes back to our previous conversation about, you know, can you just take a brick and mortar class and dump it into an electronic classroom? Not only can't you, you shouldn't, because there's so much more that you can do with this stuff. I did a seminar at BC at one point on the 1916 Irish uprising, and we found stuff online that was just amazing. Like, for example, the Irish Times put out a 200-page supplement the Sunday after the Easter uprising, describing everything that went on. And there are three copies of it extant that we know of, one of which is in the United States, two of which are in Ireland. And we found a PDF of the entire thing. And I had actually set up a Facebook page for this class. And we found, you know, people could post what they were finding. They could talk about stuff. We found, as a matter of fact, a picture. One of the reasons why Michael Collins, the founder of the IRA, was never captured is because the British never had a picture of him. And there's a monastery in Dublin that one of my students made contact with, and they had an archive. And they started sending him archival stuff, including three pictures of Michael Collins, full-fledged. And apparently they knew full well that they had these pictures in 1916 and in the subsequent Civil War, which says something really interesting about their loyalties in the way this conflict was fought.
Yeah.
And again, nobody had ever seen these because no one had asked these guys if they had any pictures. So when you get into electronic learning, especially history, it's amazing what you can do with this stuff. And having worked at Southern New Hampshire and a couple other smaller demographic schools, this position came along. And one of the things that I had always kind of been curious about was the role of NCOs. I had been enlisted in the Army. I was a scout, by the way, a cavalry scout. So I get double pluses for that by whoever gives out double pluses.
I'll send one your way.
Thank you. I appreciate that, bud.
Sure.
Whenever I taught U.S. military history, you know, one of the things that got me was that there really wasn't that much there as far as NCOs go. Even, you know, just the history of the ranks was not there. And one of the things that really interested me about this job was that it was a chance to build on something, a chance to really look at military history, U.S. military history, from a completely different standpoint. And so far, it's been very interesting. As far as this goes, there's a lot of demand for this stuff. These guys are beginning to recognize their own professionalism and develop an educational system that reflects that. More and more stuff is coming up. So it's a very challenging and very interesting job.
So do you think the things that decided in your favor when they were, you know, when they decided to offer you this position, was it based on your, probably a combination of your military experience, plus your interest in NCOs, plus your experience guiding the Department of Benedictine College? Is that kind of the stuff you think went into it?
And the fact that I knew Rob Denning, that helped a lot.
Well, I mean, I don't like to brag, but yeah.
I think that that had a lot to do with it. They were looking for someone that could both speak Army and speak academic.
Yeah.
And as they're making the transition from an academy, which is kind of a technical sort of a school, to a college, which is a more educational rather than training facility, you know, there's a demand for that. I had a conference not too long ago about what we should call our academic dean, because there's no dean rank in the Army. And he's a civilian. So where does he actually fit in? I mean, you've got the dean of the Army University, and then you've got the assistant deans, but he's not really an assistant dean because he's doing something completely different. And we ended up structuring out a proposal that's going to go forward. And possibly he'll end up being an associate dean, which is what I think he should be. But, you know, I hear a laugh. Why is there a laugh there?
Well, none of us know what deans actually do, so.
No.
Oh, hi, I'm Josh Pettisee. Sorry about that.
Well, it's the Army. No one knows what they do anyway, so it's okay.
Right.
I mean, so, yeah, okay. I think there was a combination of that. Having been enlisted made a difference. The vast majority of college, military college people that are out there tend to be officers, especially with advanced degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really don't find a lot of enlisted people or ex-enlisted people with advanced degrees. So that was definitely a source in my favor. One thing that I ought to mention, USASM is unique in the Army in one particular way. There are no officers associated with it. Commandant
yeah.
is a sergeant major. Everybody is a sergeant major. We've only got one officer, now that I think about it, associated. He's a chaplain, and he has to hang out at a different building. So being enlisted, yeah, I think that definitely made a difference.
Okay, and so now that you have this position, and you've given us a good description of what this organization does, what does a day in your life look like as the command historian for this academy?
Well, this morning I woke up. The first thing I had to do, actually today's a bad day because it's just now like 10 o'clock or something.
Oh, another day.
Okay. Yesterday, I ended up reviewing a couple of middle level, what's called ANOC or Advanced NCO courses. I ended up reviewing a lot of their historical components and their three or four sections of class. I collected some data that's going to go into the command history that has to be written every 6 months, although it really only has to be written once a month. I talked to a guy in Virginia for about an hour and a half who's also working on NCO history. I put together a prospectus on a book that is, actually I had a meeting this morning about that, and they no longer want a book, so I don't have to worry about the book component of things. I also had a pretty big fight with some people at the Center for Military History because they're coming out with what, well, the Center for Military History, which is one of two parts of the Army that deals with military history. One of the others, TRADOC, which is actually sort of what I work for. TRADOC stands for Training and Doctrine Command. They're the ones that say you need to make sure military history is incorporated into all levels of training. They're coming out with what they call the TAN series. And what the CMA, Center for Military History, does is they put out colored series on wars. World War II is the green series. Branch historians usually published Scarlet. They're coming out with the TAN series, which is Iraq and Afghanistan. And they had sent out a prospectus a couple of weeks ago looking for people to write either books or sections on books for this new series that's going to be published in the next 5 or 6 years. And they were looking for things like people that would write about dogs, for example, the role of dogs and war. Not really an encyclopedia type article. But one of the things that they did not have was the impact of Iraq and Afghanistan on the NCO Corps. How does this change them at all? What does education mean for what they do? And I sent them a letter saying, you know, I'd be interested in doing this. And their response back was that they didn't think it was important, which kind of goes, Rob, to what you were saying about most U.S. military history being written by officers. This,
yeah.
this thing's dominated by officers, and you can really tell from that response. So I called up and yelled at them for a while, and they yelled back at me. So I got yelled at for a while, and got yelling in. And I'll probably do the damn thing anyway and make them publish it just for fun. Well, I can't make them publish it, but I can make them ignore it and tell people they're ignoring it, which might also work for my purposes anyway, because I do think we need to make a lot more recognition of NCO history.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
You've got an interesting day in the life there, getting yelled at for
it's,
a while.
To ignore that like that is just, I'm not sure how you can justify that. I had a phone conference this morning. My day actually ended with a two-hour conference with our commandant talking about what we were going to do for TRADOC in the summer. This is the book that they said they wanted. Now they're saying they don't want. They want something a little bit different. So what I'm going to have to do Now, coming out of that meeting, is sketch out benchmarks on NCO history from, they want 1973, which is the end of the Vietnam War. I'm going to push it back a little bit and say we really need to start with the establishment of the drill sergeant school, which is 1962, up to the present, basically sketching out NCO education throughout that time period. So I might do that this afternoon, or at least a component of that this afternoon.
When you're writing these, are these meant for general popular audiences, or are they just meant for within the military itself, or are you shooting for a broader public?
I am shooting for a broader audience. You can get a lot of stuff from the Center for Military History, and it's good stuff. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about it. The Blue Series is general Army history. I have used that in classrooms, as a matter of fact, in teaching Army history. It's not something that an average person would necessarily pick up, but it is something that there is a demand for, especially among the educated components of the Army itself, like the CMH volume on Army history, centers around the principles of war. So you kind of have to know what those are before you get into this and see how it all works. I believe you can get them for free because they're a government publication. Yeah. And I know a lot of libraries will pick up and run with them. And I have certainly used a lot of their products in guiding students to writing papers. I've never had anyone tell me, gosh, that was a great book. I want to read it again. But they have looked at them at least. So, you know, there's that. And of course, you know, you got to be aware of your audience all the way down the line. When I wrote the thing for the NCO handbook, that was not written really for a public audience, although a public audience could have accessed it and used it. It was written for NCOs that are looking for a sense of identity and who and what they are.
So what does the curriculum look like at the Sergeant Major Academy? Is it like a general education program at a traditional university where they've got, you know, a STEM component, a history component, or is it more comprehensive? Is it more fluid? What does the curriculum look like there?
Well, the curriculum is right now under development, and it's been under development for a while. One of the problems that you have in working at an institution like this is that the demographic is so unique, is so singular. A lot of people that work on curriculum development come in with educational degrees, but the problem is that most of the training and designing curriculum isn't really aimed at people that are already really successful in their career, don't have any use for what it is that you're trying to get at, and have a really strong sense of who and what they are. So we're still trying to figure out a lot of that. There is a lot of history. There is a lot of what we would term liberal arts. For some reason, they're kind of reluctant to use that. And I've had this discussion with the chief of the Directorate of Education that actually does the curriculum design for most, well, for all of the schools and for most of the sergeant major courses. The one thing that's unique about this, I mean, you know, in many ways, it's just like what we're doing now in reviewing and considering what's the best way that we can address this stuff. We need to focus on writing, or they need to focus on writing. They need to work on writing. Most, especially senior NCOs, some of them are really good writers. A lot of them are not. So there's an emphasis on communication. There is an emphasis on history, although since we're in the process of inventing or discovering what this history is, that's becoming more important. There's a lot in terms of how to present an argument, all the rest of that good stuff. The one thing that's unique that you may not necessarily find in other schools is a staff ride. A staff ride is kind of an old way of doing military education. Basically what you do is you go to a battlefield and you, in essence, walk the battlefield. Every student has a person that they are in there, and the instructor can say at any given point, you know, you're X person, what are you doing at this point? How does this battle unfold? What's the impact of geography? What's the impact of logistics? All the rest of that good stuff. There's a battlefield close by here, Pancho Villa rated Columbus, New Mexico, which if you ever get a chance to go to Columbus, New Mexico, pack a lunch because they don't have many restaurants. In 1916, he crossed the border, raided Columbus. The Army responded. It had a little outpost there. So we end up doing that. The idea is that it's important for especially senior NCOs to understand how this kind of education actually proceeds. One of the things that I am assigned to do, as a matter of fact, is to evaluate the effectiveness of the staff ride as well. So I've been out on the staff ride a couple of times. That's probably the thing that's most unique about the education here.
That sounds interesting, because if I remember correctly, and I'm not an expert on the Pancho Villa and all that, but I imagine there probably would be some lessons to learn for the modern military today when you've got kind of a small-scale incursion into a, it's not an urban environment by any means there, I'm sure, but, you know, a village, which is kind of the thing that a lot of American military people are doing these days. It's no longer an army versus an army on a massive battlefield. It's kind of a small unit engagement in a, kind of a local village type thing.
Oh, absolutely. And even looking at the way the elements are arranged, like if you look at Pancho Villa, he's sort of a warlord, using that term loosely, and he's got sub-chiefs, if you will, and then they've got guys. These people are going in, they don't have an NCO corps, which is one of the things that I want them to change about the staff ride, versus the U.S. Army, the way it responds to this incursion with an NCO corps. It's two vastly different things. Making that point becomes really clear when you look at the way each side operated. So there's an enormous amount that you can get out of that. Absolutely.
Generally, the significance of having the NCO corps on one side versus the other is that the side with the NCO corps is probably going to be a bit more flexible. They're not going to be as reliant on the commands coming down from on high. They're going to be able to do more responses on their own without outside or without upper level leadership. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
That is, yeah. And they have better control and training. Like early in the raid, for example, there was one group that was assigned by Pancho Villa and one of his chiefs to go raid a warehouse that had a bunch of machine guns. The Mexicans stopped at a cookhouse where the cooks were beginning to cook breakfast, and they started raiding the breakfast foods instead of going after the machine gun. An NCO would say, get your butt back in and go get the stupid machine guns. You know, do what it is that you're supposed to do. The way the U.S. responded, for example, when they attacked that cookhouse, I believe there was a corporal involved. He immediately organized a defense. He had been trained over and over and over again. This is what you do. This is how you respond to this. And what should have been a piece of cake for the Mexicans, for Pancho Villa, you know, go in, get the guns, get back out, turns into this confusing little disaster, both because, well, you don't have any officers in that cookhouse, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and no self-respecting officer would be there at that point, but they do have someone that knows what they're doing, and who has trained his other people to do something in particular, whereas Pancho Villa's troops are undisciplined. They don't really have any sub-leaders, and it ends up being a disaster for them.
Okay, well, then I guess switching gears from Pancho Villa's raid into New Mexico. Everett, do you have anything to recommend for us?
Actually, yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I do, one of my functions is to sort of not exactly oversee the museum, but one of the museum that's associated with the Sergeant Major's Academy, USASMA, as it's called, is the NCO Heritage and Education Center. And for reasons that are technical and bureaucratic, it can't call itself a museum, although it's a museum in any way you want to look at things.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is how to bring in the history of the NCO, which is a really nebulous thing if you want to display it through artifacts. It's more nebulous than all that. The museum right now kind of looks like an army museum. That doesn't really fit what we're needing. And one of the things that my chief curator did that actually worked really well is he was doing a display of Afghanistan and Iraq uniforms and what they look like. And he compared it to, and actually got the armor and brought it in, a Star Wars stand trooper and pointed out how these two things looked very similar and they serve similar functions. And that actually turned out to be a very attractive exhibit. I have to say, it's something I wish I had thought of, but I didn't. So I would definitely think about history, go to museums, think about artifacts, and think about how the artifacts are arranged, not only what you think they're going to tell you, but think about the questions that they're asking and think about the relevance that a museum exhibit brings to your understanding of history, including challenges to assumptions that you may or may not have about history and the world that you live in.
That sounds like a really cool exhibit. James, do you have anything for us?
Yeah, actually. So a few years ago, one of my undergrad instructors, who became a very close friend and mentor, and we're still very close today, wrote a historical novel called Shadows Walking. And basically, his dissertation research was on Nazi doctors, which he found to be an extremely, understandably so, extremely depressing subject, and one that brought him to the point where he no longer wanted to pursue it as his PhD. So then he ended up, interestingly enough, going into a PhD that was focused on education and history. But this project kind of sat with him throughout the years, and then a few years ago he put it together, and it's the story of these two childhood friends that both became doctors. They both served in World War I. One happens, neither one of them are religious, but one of them happens to have a Jewish background and the other happens to have a Christian background. It's the story of what happens to them post-World War I, how one is increasingly brought into the ideology of the Nazi Party, while the other one is obviously increasingly marginalized within society, and what ends up happening to the two of them. So it's a pretty fascinating book that politically is, as far as talking about extremism, talking about populism, is also pretty timely now. So it's called Shadows Walking, and the author is Dr. Douglas Scott.
Shadows Walking.
Shadows Walking.
Okay.
All right, I'll have to add that to
Yeah.
my list.
Yeah, me too.
All right, my recommendation is going to be a bit more abstract. I'm not going to recommend a book or anything like that. My recommendation is simply Ulysses S. Grant. He's just one of my favorite historical actors, and one of the best memoirs I've ever read was his two-volume memoir of his time serving in the military and up through the Civil War. I wish he had talked about his years as president during Reconstruction, because Reconstruction is ultimately my favorite era in American history, so I wish he focused more on that. But luckily, there is all kinds of material out there on Grant during Reconstruction. And the thing that kind of that makes this timely is Ron Chernow recently published a new biography of Grant, which, of course, as with all Ron Chernow books, is a massive doorstop book. But it looks really interesting, and I haven't read it yet, but I have listened to interviews conducted with Ron Chernow where people talk about it, and it sounds like he has some really interesting things to say. Ron Chernow, as everybody knows, his biography of Hamilton was turned into that massive musical, and so I'm looking forward to seeing some kind of musical about Ulysses S. Grant and his era before the Civil War, during the Civil War, and as president, because I can only imagine that the song about the whiskey ring, I'm sure, will just be epic. And so I look forward to all of that.
That would be fantastic, and then you would have a musical based on Grant, but then you would have to have some type of spin to it too, like an all-Filipino cast or something like that.
That's true. It would have to be some type, the genre would have to be something unexpected also. They can't do rap again. It would have to be something completely off the wall.
How about an emo all-Filipino cast of Ulysses S. Grant?
That would be awesome.
Just called S.
Yes.
Dressed in cat costumes.
I look forward to
So,
seeing the rhymes about credit mobilier.
exactly. So, what I'm going to do right now is then bid the two of you adieu, because once I write this and make my millions off of this musical idea, I will remember the source of the inspiration.
I hope
Does
so.
that mean we get a cut of it, or you'll just remember us?
I'll name you both executive producers.
Nice.
Thanks. Appreciate that. Yeah.
There you
We'll
go.
get
Yeah.
named in the acknowledgments somewhere. I look forward to that.
Oh, there's nothing worse than
Absolutely.
being named in an acknowledgement, but like not receiving any money, right?
Nobody ever reads the acknowledgments. On
No.
that note, Dr. Digg, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
And thank you all for joining us today. To hear more words of wisdom from Everett, check out his presentation on the history of Halloween in our History Soundbite series. If you have any questions or comments on this podcast, or suggestions for future episodes, please send me an email at snhuhistory@gmail.com. For James Fennessy and Everett Daig, I'm Rob Denning. Rock on with your bad selves.
So,
I love you too, buddy.
Appreciate that. I need to hear that now and then.
Tell you it every day.
I know. It's getting it from James just isn't enough sometimes. Sometimes I need
Not
a
anymore.
neutral third
We've settled
party.
in. Yeah, we settled into this relationship.
It's totally healthy. If I remember correctly, is your actual job title, is it chief historian?
It is command historian.
That's an even more powerful title.
That is,
You like that?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
It actually is less meaningful than you think it is, but it does sound
Well.
legit.
Well, we'll go with it.
Okay.
Aren't all of our titles?
Indeed.
Yeah, that's
Indeed.
true. lead faculty makes it sound like I'm some great leader of men or something, when
what
in
are
all
you
reality,
leading?
I just sit here. Yeah, nowhere.
That's my friend, Mr. Denning.
I have one job to do. One job, and that's to sit here and ask two questions during podcasts.